Ladies Wellness on Friday, March 9th, 2007. And I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 32. Andy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 32 would require the Department of Human Services to disclose information to the public regarding cremated remains in its possession.
Great. And we have, President Courtney is honoring us with his presence this morning. President Courtney, will you come and talk with us about this issue? Thank you for coming.
Chair Tomei and members of the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. My name is Peter Courtney. I'm State Senator in District 11, which includes Woodburn, Jervis, and parts of Salem. I live at 2925 Allenview Drive North, Salem, 97303. I'm honored you allowing me to come here today and testify in support of Senate Bill 32. I was pleased to introduce and sponsor this bill, which passed the Senate unanimously last month. It's an important piece of legislation recognizing the history of Oregon State Hospital and the mental health care in our state. When the state hospital opened in 1883 through 1913, deceased patients who were abandoned or unclaimed by their family members were buried in a cemetery out there by what is now known as the famous J Building. But in 1913, due to space considerations, the remains were exhumed and they were cremated. The ashes were placed in copper canisters and they were stored in a basement. Each canister was labeled with a simple number that corresponded to the decedent's patient's name. The numbers were recorded in a book which sat on a table in the basement. Back in 2005, when I visited the hospital, there was about 3,600 canisters in an underground storage facility. That is incorrect. The facility was a simple shed out back. As you can see from these pictures that are over here, many of the canisters were corroded, and many, in fact, were fused together. And that is the room in which I found them. On that table, there were water-stained pages which contained the names of the patients as they corresponded to the, as you can see, the circled in red number in the bottom of each can. And I remember picking up in some of the cans and looking at them and touching them. As many as a quarter of the 3,654 canisters cannot be identified due to the advanced level of corrosion on the cans. Senate Bill 32 removes a major barrier to families gaining access to the remains of their relatives. Currently, the Department of Human Services cannot answer inquiries from family members without several forms of documentation that are often difficult to procure. This bill allows the department to answer yes or no to the questions. Do you have the remains of John Doe, born January 2, 1912? The bill will help provide closure and peace to many families who continue to search for their lost relatives that spent many hours and days and weeks in that facility, often so many, many years ago. This bill also allows DHS to release the names of the remains for the cremation of a memorial. I am pleased by the governor's recommendations that the current Oregon State Hospital site remain the site for the new facility. This will allow the construction of a proper memorial to accompany the new hospital, ensuring we will never forget these canisters and what they represent. I would be remiss if I did not recognize the hard work done by the Memorial Work Group, chaired by Senator Manus Anderson and Gary George, as well as the commitment from the staff and residents of the Oregon State Hospital and the staff at DHS. This bill was a team effort, and with the supreme goal of taking another step toward a final peaceful resting place for those cremains that remain in copper canisters. It is my wish that as we build that new facility out there, that we preserve at least portions of that hospital to turn it into what I call a mausoleum museum for these canisters, which now have been finally removed from this area, and they have been sealed off so at least the corrosion can stop. That picture is just a few feet from the room where the crematorium actually was. And so I very much hope that you will seriously consider this piece of legislation, that you will favorably consider it. It is an honor to be before this committee and before you, Chair DeMay. And thank you for indulging me and letting me come up here and testify on behalf of this legislation.
Thank you, President Courtney. Any questions of our esteemed guests this morning? Thank you so much. Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. If I might, I just would like to thank Senator Courtney for the work that he's done in this. I visited the hospital recently, and the room where the cremains are now held, and it's so much of an improvement over what you described, and I appreciate the work that you've done to date to make that happen. Thank you.
Chair DeMay, Representative Collins, thank you.
Any further questions or comments? Thank you so much, President Courtney. We have Joni DeTrant and Maynard Hammer.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Maynard Hammer, Deputy Superintendent of Oregon State Hospital. With me is Joni DeTrant, who is our Medical Records Director, and she's with me in case there are any detailed process questions on how we actually handle family requests. President Courtney, indeed, has been a big help on this whole issue, and he's provided much of the background that my much more mundane testimony would have covered. I am happy to answer any questions on that. Let me point out, I believe you have in your packet, after my written testimony, and by I am testifying in support of Senate Bill 32. I think the second item you have is the original bill that mandated from the Legislative Assembly that Oregon State Hospital become the central crematorium. That bill is from a Marion County Historical Society publication called the Asylum Cemetery, which incidentally lists all 1,539 names that were buried in the Asylum Cemetery. That bill also indicates that the central crematory was for all institutions, basically, in the state, not just a state hospital, but all the other psychiatric institutions, the Fairview Hospital, it was a hospital then, and the Department of Corrections institutions. We have, as of today, a count of 3,594 cremains. That was just counted yesterday by hand. We have been, as well as we can, trying to move the cremains and reunite them with the families. To the substance of the bill, as President Courtney indicated, Department of Human Services is constrained basically by two laws now. One is ORS 179-505, which basically says no psychiatric patient identification or information, except for some very limited exceptions, may be disclosed without the consent of the patient. The second is the Federal Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, HIPAA. HIPAA does apply to the Department of Human Services. The federal law prevents disclosure of protected health information except for a couple of exemptions and for treatment, payment, and operations. It applies to covered entities, and those are defined in federal law as clearinghouses, providers, and health plans. And the Department of Human Services early on declared itself a covered entity, and we've been operating under HIPAA since then. This law would direct the Department of Human Services to disclose identities of unclaimed cremated patients in our possession to family members. We cannot now do that. Under federal law and under state law, Identification is protected health information, and under the HIPAA, a person does not lose privacy rights because the person is deceased. However, one of the exceptions in HIPAA is that if state law requires otherwise and directs an agency to do something, then HIPAA does not preempt the state law. This state law, we are advised by our Attorney General, and we have vetted this a number of times with them, would preempt HIPAA and allow us to identify an unclaimed cremains to a family member without putting such a burden on the family member. And our intent would be to exercise a fairly simple due diligence and to identify patients when we get these calls. It's in the public interest to do that. It only makes sense. It's not in our interest to be a final resting place in the old crematorium for these cremains, and we think this would help a great deal. The second point that the bill would help us do is, and I say this a lot, other states have gone out, Washington, noteworthy, it was for a different reason. Several of us visited Western Washington State Psychiatric Hospital September of 2005, and I was asking them about this issue. They just published the names of any of their unclaimed cremains on the web. And that, the risk is low, but it is technically a violation of HIPAA. And Oregon being a state of law, our Attorney General wouldn't let me do that. And DHS is all behind that. So what we're trying to do here is preempt HIPAA by having the Legislative Assembly direct us to disclose the names of these cremated individuals if we have reason to do so, to have a memorial for them. And the summary of this bill really is that it helps us along the path to reunite these cremains with individuals. The pictures there, what actually was happening is with the interest of the president and as we have tried to let more light into Oregon State Hospital, many more people in the press were all interested in these canisters. Well, what happened is they were being loved to death. The more folks that went in to have a look, the more moisture there was, the corrosion advanced. And so they got to a point where they were seriously corroded, and I began to get really worried. I don't know anything about funereal practices, never knew anything about cremains, but some glimmer of survival indicated to me that with all the attention, I didn't want these cremain canisters to deteriorate before everybody. So we had a cremains protection project, and the sealed-off box that Senator Courtney was referring to really are these boxes. We were helped greatly by the funeral directors who participated in the memorial work group. This is an industry-standard cremains box. It doesn't stop the corrosion, but inside the box is a plastic bag wherein we put the canisters, we've sealed them up, and we don't let people open them anymore. Nobody opens them for pictures and that sort of thing. We moved them to another room and built shelves for them and put a dehumidifier in the room. So, again, that's not a long-term final resting place, but it's going to curtail the corrosion and keep them safe, we hope, for a few years till we have a final disposition on where they should be, which we hope will come along with the decisions on the new hospital. I don't know how much more background the committee wants, Madam Chair. I'm willing to stop there and answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Hammer. Any questions of Mr. Hammer?
Madam Chair, yes. I did have one question, and I was confused with the Washington-Oregon issue. So if this bill passes, you will publish the list?
Madam Chair, Representative Moore, if the bill passes, we would be able to publish a list of names, which we cannot now do.
Okay.
Any further questions, Mr. Hammond? Thank you so much, Mr. Hammond. I know what a good job you've done there at the hospital. We appreciate all that you do. Thank you for coming. Did you have something to say? You're just here to assist him?
Yeah, answer any questions if you have them.
Great. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 32 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 32. Representative Gelser.
Madam Chair, I would move approval of Senate Bill 32 moving to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Gelser moves Senate Bill 32 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Yes.
I just am so glad that we're working on this. And one of the things that occurs to me is that it isn't just about families being able to find loved ones and knowing who they are. I think in a country where we have a history of institutionalization of vulnerable people, what's often happened is these people have got in and they've disappeared. And I am so moved by the idea of having a memorial where we as a state recognize the value of all of these human beings that we've turned away from and imagined not to exist. So I am very proud that we're moving forward to really honor them.
I agree.
And make a difference. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Gelsey. Any further discussion?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you. I probably don't need to add on to the emotion that's been expressed here today, but my father-in-law was a patient in this institution, and fortunately, his family was with him throughout that process, and he is buried in an appropriate place. But had we been in the position of some of these families who are searching for the records of their loved ones, I can't imagine how difficult that would be to be blocked from knowing where their family members are. So I really appreciate this coming forward, and I appreciate the respect that we're affording to the individuals who were in this institution, and I needed to say that. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing your story with us, Representative Cowan. Anyone else? All right. We have a motion on the floor. Susan?
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative
Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Kotek?
Aye.
Representative
Danwar?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. Senate Bill 32 passes with unanimous consent and will go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Representative Cowan, would you like to carry this on the floor?
Sure.
Thank you. All right. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 32. And we will open the public hearing on House Bill 2180. And we'll also open the public hearing on House Bill 2469. Okay, Andy, you want to tell us a little bit about what these bills are?
Thank you, Chair. House Bills 2469 and 2180 both would have significant would institute significant changes to the TANF system and involve a number of issues, two-parent family issues. It would also address, both bills would address individuals who are potentially SSI eligible, program or work return to work activities, the post-TANF program, caps on lifetime caps on eligibility, child support issues, and case management best practices.
Great. Thank you, Andy. And we have several people who are wanting to testify. Is there anyone here who are testifying who were more than 100 miles away? All right. Seeing none, I'll just go in order that they have signed up. Denali Kennedy, Janet Scott, and Michael, is it Leacham? You just identify yourself for the record, we would appreciate that.
My name is Denali Kennedy. I work with Employment Resources Northwest. We contract with the State of Oregon DHS for the Jobs Training Program. Chair Tomei, members of the committee are sort of thank you for allowing me to be here today, and I would like to say that I am in favor of the bill proposed by Representative Kotek. There is a huge population of TANF recipients at this time that are not eligible, or that should not necessarily need to participate in the jobs activities due to mental health issues or medical issues that prevent them from being successful. And at this time, we ask them to participate 40 hours a week in job search, job training, life skills, regardless of what other issues they have going on. I think that the SSI track is very important for that population of people that are requesting that. I also think that it's very important that we have a post-TANF program. Right now, our recipients get all the support that we could possibly give while they're on TANF, but the moment that they find a job, we just completely cut them off from our services, wish them good luck, and send them on their way. And they're faced with a whole new set of challenges, including child care, transportation, housing, medical, and how to serve their family while working a full-time job. The state of Oregon has done an excellent job in putting practices into place that help people overcome drug and alcohol issues, mental health issues, child care while they're on the system. But as far as other outside barriers that they have, such as transportation, safe, adequate child care, and housing, we've really lacked in that. And so we're asking people to kind of serve themselves when they need those services and to be successful and to get a job and without any help from us on those matters. So I'm definitely in favor of the bill, and I'm offering my support. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions of this witness, Representative Gelfer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I keep asking questions on this issue of employment of people with disabilities and the SSI track. Do you think that there are services that could be offered to people that have barriers to employment, like disabilities and mental health needs? The concern being that SSI. I mean, would there be services that are offered there, or would it be a funding stream?
I think certainly we do need to offer services for people that would like those services, but I think there's a population of people that either they have disabilities that they're not necessarily wanting to work with or wanting to work through, or their children have disabilities. And because of that, child care for a special needs child is extremely hard to come by, and the state does not pay adequate funds. So a lot of those parents are forced to pay out of their pocket from their TANF grant while they're trying to participate and their children have special needs. I think certainly that the population of people that could possibly receive SSI that would like to work, I think that the state has some programs for that, and certainly we should always encourage more programs. However, the people that should be receiving SSI and are not because they don't have the adequate help to work through that process, I think that we really need to focus on helping them get their SSI.
Okay, thank you.
If I may just follow up, I'd like to point out on Section 2 of 2469, Section 2, it lists the types of work activities that could be included in our jobs program, and it does talk about vocational rehab, and I think the point made about meeting, I think the idea is that our TANF program would continue to provide the work activities to meet the needs of individuals who might have disabilities, who might want to continue to stay in jobs, but that for the population that is not the best track, that the SSI track would allow them to step back from the jobs program and work into the application process. And again, when I mentioned our day, it's voluntary. But I think the challenge with our program has been is that we haven't really supported the folks who really would like to get into SSI in a way that has made them successful. So,
Can I follow up with
a
question for? It's actually a question for Representative Kotek. Is that
that's fine?
Mm-hmm. So I think where I'm stuck, because I understand what's trying to happen. But my understanding of SSI is that it's a it's a funding stream. So if somebody was to opt out of the jobs program and we helped them to get onto SSI, I'm afraid that they would end up not having any services at all. I mean, they would get a check, but they wouldn't be getting services to help them. And is there I mean, I need to understand, is this saying that we're not going to continue, if they move to the SSI track, are we going to stop providing them with vocational training and jobs training and work experience? And I'm just having a hard time understanding that component, and that's going to help me understand the testimony better.
And I appreciate that question, and my understanding is that there would still be assistance while they are attempting to get on SSI, but I think that's a question for the department that they might be able to clarify.
All right.
But I think the challenge with our current jobs program is it's been a cookie-cutter approach, saying everyone who comes in the door goes into jobs without a recognition that there might be some other issues going on, and so... But I think that particular question around what happens to someone who's in the voluntary SSI track and what other services are being offered while they're applying is a good question. Okay. Maybe the department could clarify.
Thank you.
Any other questions of this first witness? Thank you so much for coming.
Chair, to members of the committee, I'm Janet Scott, a lead worker for case managers at the North Salem branch of Department of Human Services. I'd like to talk today about the support of the bill changes proposed. When we work with people that come to our office, they come to us in crisis. They're in a situation in an already fragile life that something's changed. Child support stopped, job cut back in hours, health problems, mental health problems. They could have had a new baby or complications with a pregnancy. All these are issues that as we start to meet with the people and putting yourself in their situation, it's come see me, sit down and tell me everything about your life in a few minutes. Everything good, everything bad. And for many families, it's difficult. They've learned to live with a lot of the issues going on in their life. We work through a good assessment program, including our partners, where we look at mental health, alcohol and drug, learning needs assessments, child care needs, resources that they may be able to tap into in the community. But at the same point, this person's in crisis. They're not hearing everything that's coming through. Everything is happening quick, and it's like, move to this door, move to this door. We give them opportunities to hear about all the programs that we have to offer for them to help make things better for their family. But again, it's very difficult. Time frames are hard. We've implemented a new process, a strength-based process of case management, working with our families. We call the Dr. Ford concept. And this offers us an opportunity to spend a little more time, if we can afford it, to take a holistic approach working with the family. I think recently about a family that I worked with, a mom with 5 children, and we were looking at ending her benefits because she had not been cooperating in our programs. As we talked with her, we were going over some paperwork, and she held this paperwork up to her face. And so we asked, you know, have you been to the eye doctor? And she says, yes, but they denied my request for contacts. In our prior processes, we probably would have moved on or said, you know, well, hope you like your glasses or something like that. In this mom's situation, the mom had a -7 degree eye need, which is pretty much that example they give you in the eye doctor's office, that really thick lens. But she also had a health problem with her eyes that only contacts would fix. With 2 appeals and 3 months later, this mom finally got contacts after however many years of never being able to see. This mom had been surviving. She was driving without glasses. She was going and taking care of her children and doing everything, and us taking the time to learn about her situation, taking the time to change the language of how we worked with her through this Dr. Ford approach of case management allowed us to work with her, and she's excited to work with us, and we see a whole turnaround, of course, in her cooperation. We also revisit her disqualifications because we missed that piece, and she didn't see it as a barrier, and we didn't know to even ask. I think also about a mom I just saw yesterday, a mom with a 4-year-old son. The son was hospitalized for asthma and bronchitis. Mom had to be off work to be in the hospital with the child. Unfortunately, mom returned to work and got bronchitis herself. She was then terminated from her job for absenteeism. If this were in a 2-parent household, which is very possible, our rules talk about the primary wage earner, the person that made the most money in the 2 years before applying for benefits. If they quit a job that was at least 100 hours a month in their most recent job in the year prior to applying for benefits without good cause or basically a reason that would cause them to be ineligible for unemployment. If they've been found ineligible for unemployment, there's no eligibility for us to help with that family working together. If a single-parent family came in with that situation, we wouldn't even look at that issue. Two-parent assistance is difficult. There's families in crisis. It isn't that both families are able to go out and get a job. It isn't that one of the parents are totally disabled, but those issues are at hand. So things come up: transportation, child care, illness, homelessness, having to leave their job because they have to relocate to move in with family. These are the two-parent households we can't help right now. So we're in great support of looking at some assistance for that two-parent household. Looking at people who have worked through our programs that we've been successful with, and we continue to assess as we work with them. But again, we're building a relationship with strangers. Smaller communities have an advantage sometimes because we know each other. I worked at one point in a rural Central Oregon area where everybody knew everybody, and it was much easier to start the conversation. But when you don't know the people and you're just walking in the door, it takes a while. So we get them to a financial security where they get a job, and then they're in a new set of changes. The way our programs are set up right now, they're no longer case managed once they get their employment and they're no longer needing the cash TANF program. They move on to another eligibility worker to handle all the rest of the program benefits that they receive. When they move on, of course, that's a change. They have no more connection with their prior case manager. They're in changes of getting used to the work schedule. I have a mom that just had a month-old baby who has a job to return to. She's a graveyard shift security officer. No transportation. How is she going to handle returning to that job? We don't want her to lose the hope, but it's working through those issues. Post-TANF will help us stay working with those families through the time that they're most fragile in returning to work. The reality of not a simulated work environment, but a true work environment where the employers are to their own rules, to their own expectations. And whether it be minimum wage or a salary, some of those expectations are very, very high and difficult. Small absenteeism for court dates, for illness, for health appointments, counseling, and other things are frowned upon. It's hard to manage your work schedule within the life of a family already struggling to put food on the table all the time and make sure that they can meet the gas bill for the $3 a gallon gas, or make sure they get their bus pass or passes for the children, make sure the kids connect with the right child care. I think about a mom whose children were in child welfare custody. Mom had issues, but mom worked to work through those issues. She went into treatment. She worked in our programs. We couldn't connect with her financially until her children were soon to be returned to her, but we did. And she worked through our programs. She did a great job. She got a job. She and her three children, she's working. We're helping with child care, medical, transportation help, and little things that might happen. But at the same point, her children were child welfare. And so the child support program said, you're now working. We're going to take 25% of your wages to pay the child support bill. There's her income. We can't deduct that income when we look at the other programs. Those children are in her home. So each program has its own rules. But right now, that would count as available income. It's just another bill that she has. Offering the post-TANF program would offer an opportunity for the mom to get her feet under her, get a stability for her and the kids, and allow her to look at that bill coming up and plan for it. In this particular situation, we were able to appeal to the child support program, and they did reduce the amount that they withheld from her wages, but they did eliminate it. They couldn't eliminate it. But we encourage you to take a close look at the bills presented. We're very hopeful that you'll accept one of them and help us to do our job better so we can help families. Thank you for the opportunity to share my testimony. Are there any questions?
Thank you very much for your very compelling testimony, and thank you both. I know you're hard workers working with these folks, and you sound like they're wonderful advocates for them, so we really appreciate that. I'm going to start off with one question. Why is it that the workers will change at a certain point? Why wouldn't the same worker stay with a family?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, in looking at a family situation and how we're funded in the agency, and I also defer to my administrator, so in case I'm incorrect, case managers are staffed at 1 to 90 TANF families. Those TANF families...
I want to repeat that because I think it's important for the committee to hear that.
Case managers are funded at 1 to 90 TANF families.
Each caseworker has 90 families.
Yes, and they deal with all the different programs. So TANF isn't the only program in the case management. If you think about 90 families and a month, it's hard to meet with even each family for an hour, let alone do the paperwork and everything else associated. So they don't get to talk to them as much. These are new families coming in as well as families on our benefits. We do get to work with them a very short time after they leave benefits, just for some stability. But after that point, the case managers can no longer afford to carry that family to work with them because we aren't staffed to be able to continue to work with them. So they move on to staff who work with food stamps, medical, child care, mainly programs. Those staff are funded at least 1 to 250 families. The conversations of case management can't continue with that change. But it's like winning them into their own independence. We also don't want to develop ourselves as a crutch to the family, but it's too soon.
Thank you. Any questions of
Simple. Thank you, Madam Chair. Was it Janet?
Yes.
Thank you for being here and appreciate all your expertise on the line. Can we explore the two-parent family issue a little bit? What are the barriers to helping the two-parent families? Is that a rule issue? Is that a statute issue? I mean, because in my bill, we're trying, you know, the 2469, we're trying to make sure that we treat the families equally, whether it's one or two-parent, and then we're talking about a state-funded two-parent track. And maybe you'll have a chance to look. I'm just wondering how the bills address the issues you were talking about with two parents.
Chair Tomei, Representative Kotek, in looking at the bills, the two-parent family, there's a brief piece in here that talks about, in your bill, about removing the deprivation criteria for a two-parent household. The unemployment part of it, I'm not sure if it's included or not. In my opinion, I believe it's a federal regulation that we have to incorporate within to our programs. And if we run our own program, we can do our own expectations of the family. Deprivation, job quit is a deprivation criteria. It's based on underemployment or unemployment. And I believe, again, that's a federal law. It's only my opinion. I don't know for sure.
And thank you. I'm still trying to totally... I'm learning as much as I'm doing this bill in terms of how the criteria works, so appreciate your insight on that we need to be treating the two-parent families as best we can, you know, meeting their needs as best we can and not asking them to basically separate to get on the program.
That's correct. It's a hardship for families who want to stay together to provide harder or more stringent expectations. It's just, you know, that's where we run into the situation of, is dad really visiting the kids all the time? Is there deprivation under the single-parent household? Is there welfare fraud? It can be, you know, fraudulent, intentional, or it could be families just trying to get by. What do? Does dad leave the home because they need some help?
Thank you. Representative Maurer?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Questions about your caseload. How many client contacts do you have per day on average?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, as a lead worker, I deal with the problem case situations, so I don't have a caseload myself, but I'm working with case managers. I would say my contacts can be up to 30 a day.
Follow-up? 30 a day.
Phone calls, people coming to the office, checking over a case.
Okay. Just as a comparison, you said 1 to 90 in your is an average caseload?
That's the staffed caseload standard.
Okay. Because in the medical field, we run panels of 1,500 or 3,000 patients per physician with as many as, you know, average between 20 and 40 encounters per day, let alone other patient contacts, and there's a substantial paperwork side. And so I guess what I'm trying to lead toward is when you talk about your paperwork requirements, do you see that as a hindrance to the system to allow you more face time with your clients?
Chair DeMay, Representative Maurer, the part of the paperwork is tracking what's happening with the family. That's necessary for anybody else to pick up the case situation. Not to discount the medical profession, as we work with the families, we're working with every aspect of their life, from school to health issues to living situations. So our discussions are more involved, I'm assuming. And as we do the paperwork, we are required to track certain things, like every 6 months we go through an eligibility check or as changes occur. To communicate with the partners that we work with, the paper trail, the communication, how are they doing, that's the paperwork that does take time, and it is critical to success for the family. So when I sit in as the lead worker for my case manager, I can open that file and I know where that family's at, and I can sort of pick up the pieces as best I can. So if their case manager has moved on to another job or they've moved to a different area, we have that information.
One last one. So this is all paper, these charts?
It's electronic. There's verbal communication. There's attendance recording for federal requirements. There's identification if there was an excused absence or not. There's requests for payments.
The question was, so your records are a combination of electronic records and paper?
Yes.
Okay.
And our families submit, of course, the paper documents. We work on an assessment form right now that the families are working on, and we're trying to develop and build on that as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for either of the witnesses that have already testified. Nancy?
Janet.
Sounds like Nancy. Oh, sorry. Almost forgot my question, but there's a part of this that's of interest to me, and I don't want you to feel like I think you're responsible for this, so you have to give a particularly long answer, but I am interested in your opinion on the private sector, particularly the charitable sector in Oregon and their assistance. As we've heard testimony here, I've been very interested and supportive of what we're trying to do to streamline this and make it a better situation for these families. But you talk about being involved in every aspect of their lives. What are the barriers to, in your casework, to involving, could be churches, it could be any kind of a nonprofit that is committed to the same kind of work you are, to find some help to fortify what is a very difficult situation? If you could just comment generally on that, I'd really appreciate it.
Chair DeMay, Representative Gilliam, our program respects families to help them to make their own decisions. We do respect their confidentiality, and we do not go out and staff our situations with people who are not involved with the family. If the family does not want us to know about a particular charitable organization they're involved with, some of the reasons that may occur there is because they think, well, if the charitable organization finds out that I'm getting public assistance, they're not going to help me anymore. Or it's, I don't want all these people to know about us and our life and our closet of information. They're, again, trying to hold on to every shred of their own personal privacy as possible. So we aren't allowed to just openly discuss. We can suggest. We provide information and resources of agencies and charitable organizations they can connect with, but unless they allow us, and we ask, if they don't allow us, we cannot include them in that holistic approach. All we can keep on doing is suggest.
Thank you. Well, that opened up a whole different area that I wasn't sensitive to, and I appreciate that answer. In addition to that, I'm interested, just generally speaking, how would you characterize the private charitable resources in Oregon for families that we're focusing on?
Chair Tomei, Representative Gilliam, our private organizations are working very hard to improve their accessibility to the community. We've been recently had the opportunity to meet with the ministerial associations who have started what's called the CAN projects in their areas, where they're going out in the local areas of where their church is located and knocking on doors and saying, hey, you may not go to church here, but we're here. We're here to help you. Can we help? They've gone out. They've helped clean up yards. They've wanted to become a part, but again, recognizing that families have a privacy and may also have a different faith base or feel that they don't want to be a charity case. Mm-hmm. When we talk about activities, sports, ballet, arts, we suggest that the parent ask for a scholarship. The parent is reluctant to do that. They may not even want their child to attend for whatever reason, because they don't want to have themselves looked at as a charity case. So again, it's pride of the family, and we need to respect that. It's difficult. But I know the charitable organizations are there, and we do try to connect generally and talk with them as we can to identify how they could get out there. They put posters up in our office and some different things at times when they have something going on, so families can be aware and just maybe happen by that activity and say, oh, what you doing?
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome.
May I follow up on that?
Yes.
There are a lot of charitable organizations.
Could you announce who you are again?
Oh, I'm Denali Kennedy with the EARN program. There are a lot of charitable organizations in this area. There are quite a few that have certain criteria based on who's eligible for the services that they offer. So not everybody in the TANF program is necessarily eligible for each charitable foundation. Another piece that we run into is that a lot of the charitable organizations are only open, because it's a volunteer program in a lot of cases, are only open at certain times. A lot of the TANF recipients are in programs that are only open during those certain times also, such as jobs programs, where they have to be in this particular job training program from 8 o'clock to 1 o'clock. And if that falls at the same time that the charitable donation organization is open, they may not have the time, especially with the bus schedule, which we all know can take 2 hours to get from one side of town to the other, to necessarily have access to those resources. So there are limits on how much they can access.
Thank you very much. Okay, I'd like to give us your name and identify yourself, please.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, I'm Mike Leachman. I'm with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I'm going to be brief. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you in more depth last week. I did want to share with you, however, some new materials that we have. I brought some written testimony from last week's testimony, as you had requested. Secondly, I've shared with you written testimony for today from Sarah Merton, who joined me last week. She wasn't able to be here with us this morning, but wanted to share with you her written testimony. Third, you'll find an issue brief that we're releasing today that focuses on nine policy options that we consider to be key issues and that are facing us in improving the TANF program today, and discusses those policy options and indicates how they are handled in House Bill 2469 and House Bill 2180. So we hope that you find that useful. I just want to mention, I'm not going to go through all of them, but I just want to pull out, make a couple of points that may be particularly salient in the piece. The assessment process, both bills provide for improvements in our current assessment process, and as we've discussed previously, this is it's very important, we think, for our assessment are upfront assessments and assessments ongoing as people work their way through to self-sufficiency be improved. I would just say that because this is so important, that the committee pay particular attention to the details of the assessment program that is being proposed as you work through. The quality of that assessment program is crucial. If we're making modest or minor improvements, it's not going to be enough to give us an especially more effective program. We're spending now about a quarter of our combined TANF and TANF maintenance of effort money in child welfare. The rules allow us to do that, and child welfare doesn't have enough money, and so we're spending a quarter of our TANF and TANF and MOE money in that area. If we had a better assessment program up front when these families are first entering the program, we might be able to save some money on the back end when families have fallen apart. Secondly, sanctions. This is an area where the two bills have significant differences. While assessments are especially important up front, we also think that it's important to have a good thorough assessment process to the point where we're preparing to sanction people. Studies nationally have shown that people who are sanctioned have more mental health and physical health problems and lower education levels, a number of other barriers that that if we had an assessment process that was careful before we sanctioned people, we might catch those barriers and make our sanctioning process more effective. Thirdly, with time limits, and then I'm just going to touch on two other things after this. Time limits, I think the main point here, and it's widely misunderstood, it may be the most misunderstood issue in TANF, in the TANF reauthorization process nationally. We can have whatever time limit policy we want. It's widely known that the federal law sets a 5-year time limit for lifetime TANF receipt. But that's only a 5-year limit on TANF paid for with federal funds. So states are free to set whatever time limit policy we feel is in the best interest of our program, and then we can figure out how to deal with the funding once we figure out what the best practice is, what the policy is we want to implement. The other one I'll pull out of here is child support, and just to note that that 2180 does not currently include any infrastructure to pass through child support funds to families. 2469 at least creates a structure through which we could run a pass-through. And then lastly, the income limit. Neither bill includes increasing Oregon's countable income limit. And here I'll refer you to the charts that I also shared with you this morning. And wanted to do this to give you some sense of context about what's happened with the income limit since 1991 when it was frozen. We haven't increased the income limit since July of 1991. It's $616 for a family of three. Because of inflation, that income limit is much tighter than it used to be. You have to be a lot poorer than 15 years ago to be eligible for assistance. Similarly, the grant amount has also not been adjusted for inflation, and so it's lost a third of its value in the last 15 years. The last chart, figure 4, provides you with some context about the total spending adjusted for inflation on self-sufficiency programs in Oregon. we're including here the cash assistance, TANF cash assistance, and its predecessor cash assistance program, also jobs, emergency assistance, and the employment-related daycare program, which is, while not being considered in these two bills, is often it is part of our effort in Oregon to help families move to self-sufficiency. So including all the spending for clients to reach self-sufficiency through these programs, there's been a very significant decline, adjusting for inflation, since a little over a decade ago, in particular about a $360 million decline in our spending in these areas. Again, while we've seen some significant caseload declines in the TANF program, since welfare reform, poverty among families with children is flat. As you work your way through the program and talk to your colleagues about spending reform this program at this particular moment, because we're not going to get another chance to really do this kind of overhaul for some time again, I wanted to make sure that you had the context to see how much this program has been disinvested really in the last more than a decade. Thanks very much for the chance to testify today, and I'll take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Leachman. Any questions of this witness? Thank you all very much for coming to testify. We have Emily from Oregon, and John Mullen, and Sarah Radcliffe. I know some of you were here on Wednesday, and I want to thank you for coming back.
Should I get started?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Emily Katz from CARE Oregon. I'm the public policy manager. And before I read from my prepared testimony, I just want to take a minute to say that we've heard a lot about the jobs program in TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. I hope you don't mind if I call it TANF from now on. But I'm here just to call your attention to the TANF medical side. I'm going to give you a little bit from the CARE Oregon perspective, but I just want to commend Representative Kotek, members of the department, the governor's office, and the Oregon Center for Public Policy in the work that they've done just to really take a good hard look at the overhaul while we have this opportunity. And so I just want to stress that the TANF medical side is critical to these families as they're going through these changes. So like I said, I'm Emily Katz. I'm the public policy manager for CARE Oregon. We're a Medicaid managed care organization and a Medicare special needs plan. We serve 95,000 members of the Oregon Health Plan. We're a fully capitated health plan, or an F-CHIP, meaning we're capitated by the state or paid on a per-member-per-month basis. We assume all of the health care financial risk for some of the state's most vulnerable people. I'm here to present CARE Oregon's perspective on today's discussion about the programmatic changes to TANF. At any one time, a third of our members receive TANF medical benefits. In January of 2006, CARE Oregon had 97,393 members, 38,477 of which were on TANF. In January of 2007, we had 94,950 members, only 29,958 of whom were on TANF. When over 8,500 CARE Oregon members on TANF lose medical benefits over 12 months, it's very concerning for us. And another one of the F-CHIPs that shares our concerns is Family Care, located in Portland. They've experienced similar declines and asked me to share that with you. Over this year of enrollment decline, no single eligibility category lost more members than TANF, and among the different age categories in TANF, no single age group lost Oregon Health Plan coverage faster than the adults on our plan. It's easy to speculate that most of these people join the ranks of the state's uninsured or underinsured. We ask that as you make decisions about reshaping TANF, you're cognizant of the critical medical benefits provided by the TANF medical program for families and not increasing the number of Oregonian families that are uninsured. Those leaving TANF for mostly low-wage work often do not have access to employer-sponsored insurance for them, let alone for their family. Allowing those who are in TANF and the new pre- and post-TANF programs that I hope are set up to retain their medical benefits is key to the health success of these families and for the TANF program. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay. Thanks for being here, Emily. This is an issue around the transitional medical that's come to my attention, and we'll be drafting an amendment to deal with making sure that in the pre and post that we're accounting for some of that so we can do that. So hopefully we'll have that discussion in the work group.
That's wonderful to hear. Thank you, Representative Kotek, and thank you for all your work in reshaping this program. Thanks.
Representative Maurer.
A question about the assessment period for the assessment, and there's been a lot of discussion about the assessment. Does Care Oregon come with some creative ways of integrating the medical piece into the assessment in a more integrated way?
Can you, in terms of the assessment, can you clarify a little bit? I'm sorry, I'm not sure if I understand.
Well, because I don't know TANF, and this is all new to me, it just seems to me that the assessment piece, it's been discussed by almost everybody that's testified, and saying that we don't have a good assessment program,
right.
And that one of the issues is that these people come in with medical problems, comorbidities that really preclude them from finding work. And so, you know, does Care Oregon have a plan to help integrate the assessment piece with the social service side?
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, members of the committee. Care Oregon, I didn't come here today to talk about any plan, but I do believe that the assessment needs to be a proper assessment and take into account the health needs of these families as they come in. That is key to getting them to the proper track or the proper line of care. In terms of the case management, Care Oregon does not provide the direct case management. That falls under the jurisdiction of the department, I believe, and please someone correct me if I'm mistaken. But Care Oregon does look at ways to sort of creatively deal with the delivery system as a whole, and this would definitely be a part of it. But again, I would just say that the assessment piece is critical, and we'd be happy to work with the department in figuring out a way to be sure that the folks on TANF are receiving the proper medical benefits that they need. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, John Lane at the Oregon Law Center. And with me today is one of my colleagues, Sarah Radcliffe, from the Oregon Law Center in Portland. We wanted to be sure to have a field perspective on the issue of sanctions for the committee's information. While I also have praise for both the department and for Representative Kotek for bringing forth this issue this session, we're of the opinion that working with Representative Kotek's bill is the proper vehicle for us working further on the discussion that you have heard. One of the things that I want to emphasize, again, to Representative Maurer's point, virtually everybody has talked about assessments and how important they are. And I think the testimony of the clients on Wednesday really pointed out those issues very dramatically about the help that they needed, sometimes got or sometimes did not get. So we have some concern to make sure that the skills are there for the assessments, the training is there, and then when necessary that there's the option to contract out for the proper kind of assessment that's needed. And obviously for issues of mental health, drug and alcohol issues, that comes to the fore as one of the areas, of course, where that outside assessment is going to be very helpful. I have a lot of experience in running an organization that worked on the former General Assistance Program, so I'm very familiar with TANF SSI issues and know how difficult it is to gather all of the information and make sure to present the proper case. I very much appreciate Representative Gelser's continuing discussion about issues of disability. I was among the many people that were disappointed when the state defunded the employment initiative that helped seniors and people with disabilities system to work with people, even people in long-term care, but people that had disabilities, to be proactively involved in helping them to find jobs and to get back into the system. And we had many successes in Clackamas County that I was very proud of. So one thing that I would hope would be something we could revisit at some point in time is taking a look at what worked in the employment initiative program and look to bring that back. A couple of other things that I want to just mention in passing. Of course, they're very much in favor of the post-TANF program. Again, running a local agency, you would oftentimes see people that had left TANF and be right back with the community action agency near homelessness or having food and transportation, other kinds of issues. So post-TANF is going to help as people become, they have more experience in their jobs over a period of time, hopefully can advance and have this temporary supplement to help them along. I also think that the points that Mike Leachman brought up today, the additional points, are really worth focusing a little bit on, because as much as I'm proud of the effort that's going on this session and the discussion about TANF, the issues about the grant and the income standards are really glaring. To live at 36% of the poverty level, and again, I know from my experience in Clackamas County, if you're at 36% of the poverty level, you can't rent anything for a family and be able to be self-sufficient, so you have to look at ways in which you can double up with other families, and that creates other kinds of crisis and issues. This program has not had an increase going back to 1991, I believe, as far as the grant is concerned. And the aspect, if it's confusing about that, the income standard and the grant, because there's such a small gap there, we basically have virtually nobody in the state of Oregon on TANF that's that is employed, that is working, because as soon as you earn just a very little bit of money, you're essentially ineligible for the program. And other states do that differently. And frankly, one of the concerns that I do have is that, given the very low grant and the very low income standard, about how difficult it is going to be to meet work participation requirements under the federal changes. So in closing, I would just say that the Oregon Law Center stands ready with our friends and colleagues that have worked on this issues to work with the committee and with the department to look at ways in which we can improve this program and get the best possible bill we can get on TANF restructuring this session. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Any questions of this witness? Representative Maurer.
Yes, Madam Chair. Mr. Mullen, I look back and I see since 1991 the grant level hasn't changed, and I did not know that until today. And it seems interesting to me that through the 90s we had double-digit increases in state revenues and funding increased in a number of programs. We added dozens of new programs in the state. And why wasn't TANF ever included in at least a cost of living increase somewhere in the 90s?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I'll give you my opinion. One of the things that happened in the discussion in the early 90s was about the concern about caseload, the rising caseload, and the caseloads were rising prior to welfare reform. And then when welfare reform came into place, some of the discussion, frankly, at that time that I heard from the department was about not wanting to make the caseload an attractive place to be. So one of the things to do was not to raise the amount of money that people got to ensure that they were interested to go ahead and move on to jobs. Now, that's my opinion, and I'm sure there would be other people that would dispute that. But I think that your point is well taken. There was not the political will or muscle or as much as advocates, and there are many advocates, including Ellen Lowe, who's in the room, who did a considerable amount of work to try to bring that to people's attention, but it just didn't get traction.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Mr. Mullen, or as I like to call him, Nancy. Sorry about that earlier. I should have said that. You know, this is probably a naive question, and nobody on the panel will be surprised at that, but I'd like your opinion on this whole issue around, you know, what with the numbers and figures that were shared with us and that you highlighted were dissuading people to work, you know, on TANF.
Yes.
And what can we do to the business community to without violating the dignity and the feelings of the folks on the program to say, look, if you hired this person who you've said has some potential and could fill this slot, there is another issue. Can you help us in the transition in the beginning here? It may take some more money. It may take some more understanding so this worker gets traction. I mean, all workers have to have training and orientation. This may take a little more, but the benefit, you know, will be much greater. What can we do to get the business community to be more sensitive, more helpful in this area so folks will want to work and not be discouraged?
Madam Chair, Representative Gilliam, I think those are really insightful kinds of questions. One of the things that I was proud of in Clackamas County is the way that we worked through the Workforce Investment Council that had a heavy involvement from the business community, and the business community being very open to the, particularly the participant members, very open to the idea of giving people an opportunity, a chance to work. And Clackamas County often, if not all the time, exceeded the placement level of income, in other words, the hourly rate. There was strong interest in the business community in that. So I think that that discussion is important on a planning level. And then on an individual level, quite frankly, here again is where something like the Employment Initiative, a program, was very successful, where our staff person could call an organization, a business, and say, we have this person that has some significant disabilities but is very interested in working. Here's what their background is about. And develop a relationship. So, and if I might just tag on to that just a bit, your earlier discussion about charitable organizations, I also like the way we worked on that in Clackamas County, because it's both from the planning perspective of how we work together as a community, and then the individual work that can happen from workers to a resource to say, this person needs a refrigerator, or you know, some of those kinds of things where you can be true to the confidentiality and have the consent of the client to do this kind of work, but to work together as a community, because truly, this program cannot really work unless we're working together as a community.
Any other questions of any of these witnesses? Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Radcliffe. I'm a lawyer with the Oregon Law Center. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'd like to specifically address the issue of sanctions, because there are a couple important ways that House Bill 2469 differs from 2180 with regard to sanctions. 2469 would require DHS to assess the family for disabilities and for harm posed to the children prior to imposing sanctions. And secondly, 2469 prevents the child's portion of the TANF grant from being reduced due to the adult's noncompliance with a case plan. So first I want to address the assessment piece, which we've talked about a lot. But basically, assessments allow the agency to address the root cause of noncompliance rather than just penalizing the family. And there's research across the country that shows that sanctions tend to be correlated with the most vulnerable families, the neediest families, the families with the greatest barriers to employment and achieving self-sufficiency. One study concluded that caregivers who had the most complex and challenging daily lives were more likely to have experienced a loss of benefits. TANF participants who have less education, less work history, more children, and younger children are all more likely to be sanctioned. And higher rates of sanctions are associated with family health problems, with disabilities, including caring for a child with a disability, mental health issues, illiteracy, alcohol and drug problems, domestic violence, and then logistical issues such as lack of transportation and lack of child care. So basically, unless we assess families for these barriers prior to imposing sanctions, we're going to be cutting off aid to the neediest and the most vulnerable families, probably without imposing requirements on those families that are appropriate to the family's strengths and barriers, and without offering the services and support that those families need to have success. The current practice, while I think the Department of Human Services would say that their policy is to assess families, and I think that that's important to caseworkers as well, it doesn't seem like that's happening on the ground. In response to a recent request for information that the Oregon Law Center filed with the agency, DHS reported that 59% of families who were sanctioned between July 1999 and December 2006 had not been assessed for either mental health issues or substance abuse. We also asked about learning disabilities and literacy, but the department doesn't keep statistics on how many sanctioned families are assessed for those issues. Recently, I was speaking with a lead caseworker in Multnomah County about a client of mine who had been in special education her whole life and had been on TANF for 4 years and hadn't been assessed for a learning disability. And this lead caseworker expressed to me that this was a real concern of his. And he went ahead and looked at the figures for Multnomah County and told me that only 55% of families in Multnomah County have been given the CASIS test, which is just a basic literacy, writing, and math test. So his feeling was that there are a lot of TANF families where caseworkers don't even know whether or not the adult in that family can read and write. So real basic questions, I think, often aren't getting asked. Also, in preparation to talk with you today, I spoke with a number of attorneys that I work with throughout the state and was just flooded with stories. Families who have been sanctioned or threatened with sanctions for refusing to comply, but in fact couldn't comply because of a disability or some other kind of extenuating circumstance. Just a brief example, a single mom was facing sanctions, and after a community health nurse and a lawyer with the Oregon Law Center got involved with her case, it became clear that this was a mother who had recently escaped domestic violence. She was severely depressed, and she had very low cognitive functioning. So with the lawyer and the nurse's help, she was able to avoid sanctions and to apply for SSI and ultimately was approved for SSI. But I think examples such as this one illustrate that rather than funnel families into a one-size-fits-all case plan and then wait for them to fail and cut off benefits, we really need to be identifying the family's strengths and barriers, creating case plans that have appropriate requirements, and offering the services and the tools that that family needs. The second piece that I wanted to address is why it makes sense to impose sanctions on the adult caretaker but not the children. I think we all know that TANF is a child-centered program, and the policy should be to protect children at all costs, even when the caretaker fails or is unable to comply with the program's requirements. And secondly, there's no evidence proving that full family sanctions are more effective than partial sanctions. In fact, some studies show that programs with moderate sanctions are just as effective in promoting compliance as programs with full, extreme, total sanctions. And I think we can all imagine that if you're a family of three surviving on $514 per month, you're going to feel the loss of every dollar from that budget. So it doesn't take a complete loss of benefits in order to make an impression on the family.
Ms. Redliff, let me stop you just for a second. So how do you impose sanctions on the parents without the sanction also affecting the children?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that's a good question, and I think the theory is that you would take out the adult's portion of the grant and remove that, but not touch the children's portion. I think, obviously, families budget collectively, so that may, in practice, you know, it may affect the children. It would affect the children, but that's the theory.
Okay, thank you. You can continue.
I think that's actually what I had for my prepared testimony, but I'm glad to take questions.
Thank you. Any questions of this witness?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Sure. I continue to be stunned at this assessment piece and that these appear to be not, I mean, common sense approaches that you, the inability to read, the literacy issues are... I mean, you should be able to see those, you know, anybody that is trained in this area ought to be able to figure it out in a matter of minutes, and that how come there's not a connection between the caseworkers in the school districts that these people came from, because they have, most of them probably had, when they were in school, IEPs, or individual educational plans, and why do we not have access to that? I'm asking a rhetorical question, maybe, but I just it just seems, you know, your testimony is stunning.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I think just in a conversation with one caseworker, he said that he actually figured out that one of his clients couldn't read because he looked through her file and realized that applications that she had submitted were in different people's handwriting, and it didn't look like she had actually filled them out. So he presented that to her, and it turned out that she didn't have basic reading and writing skills. So I think that's just evidence that it really does take a thorough assessment and, you know, looking at those education records. And I think just the current setup doesn't facilitate that, probably for a lot of reasons.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I feel compelled to make a comment because I think it would help for the committee's sake. I think because of our income limits and how we've structured our program, years ago, we had families who were working that might have had employment experience, were functioning in the sense that they didn't have as many barriers. We've decreased the income limit in such a way that the families that are eligible once they come in the door are more likely now because they have practically no income, and there's a reason for that. And so I think, I wouldn't want to give the impression that every family who walks in the door has significant issues. But because of the income issue, I think we are seeing more families in this population now that have barriers because of how we've structured the program. And so we have to make sure the program adjusts to the fact that if we're not going to increase the income limit, then we should be aware that many families coming in have a lot of issues. That's why they're not working. So I just want to clarify that for folks, that that's why the population looks the way it does, because of what we've done to the program. There will still be families who will come in the door that, you know, they just need a hand, they're going to be down the door, and they'll be fine. But we have a lot of families who won't without some specific resources.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any further questions of this panel? Thank you all very much, and thank you for all the work that you do. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue?
I was signed up, I think.
Might have been last week, Marcia. Come on.
In Illinois. I was right after John Mullen, I believe, on Wednesday. So.
Oh, okay. We didn't continue with that list, so that's fine.
Go ahead, Marcia. Chair Tomei and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm a member of the American Association of University Women of Oregon Public Policy Committee. And with your indulgence, I will abbreviate AUW from now on. It's a big mouthful. AUW has a long commitment to education. In fact, our association is celebrating its 125th anniversary starting in November to celebrate 17 college-educated women getting together in Boston, deciding what they could do to help women achieve economic security and educational levels in an era when women's ability to think and go to college was in question. The first program that AUW did, the first research report, was on the need for sewers in Washington, D.C. in 1885. We've always been involved in education. In fact, education as the gateway to economic security is our current theme, and we ask our branches, 28 around the state and 1,300 around the nation, to use our programming time to work through those processes, education as a way of security. And that's going to be my take on the TANF reauthorization, utilizing education to get some of these families back into the workforce. We also agree that the assessment is very important. And after reading both 2180 and 2469, we feel that we should work with Representative Kotek's bill because it is much more specific in what kinds of programs can be utilized under TANF. And I think there's one line in there that says education. We're not new to this issue. We've been supporting the Parents as Scholars or the Degree Completion Initiative since 2001. I know that I've personally been involved in it for AUW. In fact, I sat on the work group for the rulemaking for the Degree Completion Initiative, which allows a small number in Oregon, 100 in Oregon, to participate in education up to 12 months to maybe attain their AA or their college degree. And we think very strongly that this is a good way to go. Our hope is that the Oregon legislature restructures the TANF efforts to be as flexible as possible to allow families to access to post-secondary education. We all know that higher education increases the likelihood of family economic security. And I'm going to read directly from our association statement on that issue. Because statistics prove that educational access is inextricably linked to economic security, AUW believes that women and girls must have access to education and job training to achieve economic security. We also believe it of men, but we focus on women. Only by improving their employability and job through education and job training can women attain jobs that pay a livable wage and stay off public assistance permanently. States must also have the flexibility to target recipients with job searches, education, and job and skills training to respond to the needs of local labor markets. Education and training programs must not be viewed as separate from work, but as part of a continuum of activities that result in work. And on the association level, we are prepared to help the states as they try to make flexible programs work. We have a volunteer lobby corps from Virginia, Maryland, and the D.C. area that every week that Congress is in session calls on congressional offices, and our association will continue to support Maine Senator Olympia Snowe's or any other efforts to make it easier for states to create programs patterned after the touted Maine Parents as Scholars. Since some of you are new to the TANF issues and the Parents as Scholars program, let me tell you a little bit about Maine's program. The Parents as Scholar program helps TANF-eligible parents obtain a post-secondary degree to gain the skills they need to secure well-paying jobs that allow them to be financially secure and raise their families out of poverty. Parents as Scholars participants receive the same cash assistance and support services as other eligible TANF recipients while they are successfully participating in an educational program. According to a survey of graduates, Parents as Scholars graduates earn a median wage of $11.71 per hour after graduating compared to the median hourly wage of $7.50 for welfare leavers without post-secondary degrees. This is directly from the Maine's report on their TANF program, and the statistics were from 2004. They use maintenance of effort dollars to help their TANF recipients attain their educational levels. And from last Friday's Bangor, Maine Daily, the Bangor Daily News, I will quote true so that you know that we're just not pie in the sky and wanting you to be flexible with the way that you treat the TANF free authorization programs here. Senator Olympia Snowe has for several years tried to persuade Congress to make it easier for states to create their own Parents as Scholars program, but hasn't succeeded in part because the Bush administration opposes it. She says she will try again this winter and with a Democratic Congress may have better luck. And for the record, both Senator Olympia Snowe and Senator
Susan Collins
of Maine, both Republicans, are very, very invested in the Parents as Scholars program. So our urge to you is to place in statute the flexibility to use education as a means of opening that gateway to economic security for Oregon families. I will also reiterate the offer that I made to the Department of Human Services during our work on the work group for the Degree Completion Initiative, and I will personally work to find mentors for any person participate in the program who would like to have a mentor while they are doing that education that will help their family become economic, physically secure. They would have to agree to do that, but I will personally look among our 2,000 members in 28 branches to find someone to help them.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Any questions of Ms. Kelly? Thank you very much. Ms. Lowe?
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Ellen Lowe, legislative advocate for the Oregon Food Bank, and the folks in those regional food networks and pantries across the state often refer to me as their messenger. And I'm departing from my prepared text to say, in my role as a messenger for low-income Oregonians, Representative Maher, I think I failed. I know I failed during those 90s. But I think there were some things that happened at that time, and I'd like to just mention them. One, there was a shortage of workers, and so it was fairly easy for low-skilled folks to get work. And so I'll never forget hearing a deputy director of DHS, who is no longer there, but talking about when people came into the office of then it was AFS in Lebanon, that there was a sign with an arrow to the work desk. And that was the extent of the assessment. And so we had a number of folks in that time who were able to get marginal, low-skilled jobs. But the reason that they were presenting themselves in the first place was never really looked at. And so I would suggest that when we look at TANF, it's temporary assistance for needy families. If we really want it to be a temporary time in their life, we're going to spend a little time when they first come in to find out what their real needs are. And then we will be able to chart with them a strategy, a work plan that will allow them to move into whatever level of independence is appropriate for them. And I am so convinced that in the long run, we will save public dollars. We certainly will save families. And remember, it's children and adults, if we spend that time very early. And so the gentleman who was here from Chemeketa earlier talked about the extent to which you have been listening, and I've noticed it. I truly believe in the two workers you had here today. You have an example of people who are involved at those receiving ends when that people come in, who, if they have the time, would be able to do the kind of listening, and so that then there could be real partnerships. And the area where I spend most of my time is healthcare. And many of these individuals really need some help there. It's also true as they're beginning to leave the program and some of those core services, that as they go out into the workforce, that there continues to be some contact to help them, as because there are going to be probably some bumps in the road. But again, an investment so they won't really be returning. I just want to briefly mention a couple of things. One, Michael Leachman, in the paper that he presented where he addressed earnings disregard. And really, what we could do would really give an opportunity to more of these families to involve themselves in some gradual part-time work. And then they would be able to gradually go to full-time. And that's particularly true for parents with very young children. You've heard a lot of the numbers about the finances, but there's one word that was used this morning, and I think it also tells something about what happened during the 90s. Remember, that's when we had ballot measure 5. So there was some movement of dollars from the state general fund to public education. And so that was part of what happened. There was also the premise that with the Children and Families Commission that there would be a need for fewer dollars in child welfare and child protection within DHS. Well, the TANF dollars were fungible, to use your terms, and so then you saw where there was a disinvestment from directly with the families to some within child welfare. I mention that because I really think that I sincerely hope, and a couple of you do spend some time with the dollars on the other end of this, just down the hall in this building, is to look at really what we have done in allocating some of those federal dollars. And maybe there, I shouldn't say maybe, there is a need. This is a public good, a public purpose. It really does demand some general fund dollars to begin to come back in, because two-parent families, you've heard about that today, that is something where it's worthwhile to make a state investment. The other thing that I would like to bring up is the importance, in addition to the dollars and cents, of the family, the ties that can be built by two parts of what you have facing you. One is allowing a mother to stay with her infant until the infant is 12 months old. Now, I can remember in times past where that was not just staying at home with the child. There were programs that were within DHS and parenting and nutrition and all of those things that gradually then led to the mother being able to be part of the workforce. And the other is the pass-through of child support, utilizing the federal ability to have $100 for one child, $200 for two or more without penalty. And it isn't just the dollars. It's building that relationship then between the non-custodial parent and the children and the former spouse or partner, and so that that can continue after they leave TANF. You're more likely to build a trust level, not only between the department and the non-custodial parent, you're more likely to build some connections between those children and the non-custodial parent. And remember, temporary assistance for needy families, that's the children, and it's both the custodial and the non-custodial parent. John Mullen and I, he then was a bureaucrat and I was the public member, were part of the Oregon Option. And back when we first had an opportunity to look at TANF, I look back at our expectations and what has happened, and it is dismal. I sincerely hope you put together a roadmap that will allow future legislators to look at what you've done with a great deal of pride. And I thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Ms. Lowe, for your testimony and for all the work that you do.
Any questions of Ms. Lowe?
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you. I just wanted to clarify that since the 2469 bill came out, there's been discussion around the child support. So we are drafting some amendments to clarify some of that. And so for discussion for the work group as well, because it's clear from my bill that we didn't actually clarify what we meant by around child support. But as the department also has a lot of amendments they want to make, so we'll be going through all of those in the work group, I'm sure.
Chair Tomei, Marsha Kelly, if I may, let me just add to what Ellen said about some of the money and the dollars that have happened to support children's and family. In the 2001 session, when I was employed as a lobbyist for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition and AUW, I ran into one of the LFO staff people who asked me what I was doing in the building, and I said I was advocating for financial security for women and families, and he said, oh, I hate to tell you this, but we've just cut $20 million out of that budget. That was general fund dollars. That may also help to answer the question about why the amounts have not gone up. That was a 2001 session, and if you remember, that was right at the beginning of the economic downturn before all of the cuts happened. It was on top of all of that, and we have never recovered.
I know, Ms. Kelly. Thank you. Representative Cullen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I could make a couple of comments. First of all, I would just like to thank Marcia and certainly Ellen for the years of work that you've put into many of these issues. I've seen your faces and heard from you many, many times over the years, and I know how much energy has gone into this this whole effort. I think we heard some critical things here today that I want to make sure that we take note of, certainly around how critical assessment is in making sure that what we do are temporary assistance programs, and around addictions treatments and mental health assessments and care. And it ties into what I've been hearing from the business community, who are looking for employees who are ready to go to work. And we simply must address some of those issues to be partners with the business community and make that possible. But certainly around education as well, and the concept of assessing literacy before we start trying to move people down paths that they may not be ready to take. I actually have a long-standing grudge with AAUW because I was once refused membership in this organization because I wasn't a college graduate. So I finished that off in 1997. But I'm going to try to put that aside for a moment, because what I'd like to make sure that we capture here is I heard an offer of mentorship for any individual who wishes to seek an educational path and for whom we can give a little support. And I want to make sure that that doesn't get lost along the way, because if an adult is moving into an educational path a little bit later in life, the assistance from someone who can be there to mentor and to hold their hand and to help them work through some of the rough spots, I think is invaluable. And I want to make sure that that offer gets used.
That's how come I did it in this setting. Thank you very much. And there's one other thing I'll put on a separate hat in talking to the business community. Representative Gillum's question. In my prior life, before I started being in the halls here so often, I owned a small business that it was a service-oriented business, a travel agency, and we did offer people opportunities to get some work skills at our office, because someone from one of the nonprofits came in and said, I need to place someone in an area like this. She had had a back injury and had been working, but she needed to develop some different skills. And I think that if you approach businesses with individual people that, you know, maybe fit that a bit, it is very helpful. She was with us only for a short time, but it gave her some good job skills that she may not have had otherwise. And so that's part of the key, is making sure that there are people out there who can go out and individually contact small business owners, because small business owners don't have the time to run around and try to contact all of the many programs that might have those, have people who are needing those skills.
Thank you, Ms. Kelly. Representative Gelfair.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I also wanted to make a couple of comments. The testimony today from everyone was incredibly helpful, and I'm so pleased that we have the opportunity to move forward. And Representative Kotek, in her bills, I think, is really addressing things that are going to strengthen families in that assessment process. The last panel really raised up for me, it brought some of the thoughts and concerns that I have around that employment together, and it's that conversation about education. And if I think about what Representative Kotek mentioned about the folks that are coming in are people that have tremendous barriers. Many of them, I guess, probably have a lot to do with learning disabilities and challenges that began in the school years when people weren't getting maybe adequate supports to achieve in school, which caused me to think, this is all coming back to TANF, don't worry, mm-hmm. about the challenges with the No Child Left Behind Act, where the benefit is disaggregating data and going and looking at underachieved groups and holding districts accountable for that. The backside being the hammer ends up coming down on the very kids that we try to help. And I think that that is the problem in the system right now for the individuals that have the barriers. The hammer comes down on individuals that can't achieve employment because they don't have the tools to do it. So I think the assessment piece is going to provide that opportunity. And I think for that population that I've raised that I'm concerned about, if we think about that extension of an educational path or educational opportunities, recognizing that some of those that have disabilities that might go into that SSI with access to educational supports might be able to come off of SSI so we don't move them to that income source and institutionalize them into poverty forever. And I think that maybe in the work group working around that one size fits all, what would that look like if it wasn't a 40-hour work week, if it was a different type of educational program, maybe not even GED attainment that builds on that idea of not one size fits all, and maybe that SSI is as a track that's moving forward to support people with the income they need because they're going to lose it because they can't achieve what TANF is telling them, but at the same time giving them some of the benefits of the programming supports and training that TANF might offer to others to help pull them out of that. So this, all of the testimony today was helpful in clarifying those questions for me, and I hope those are some of the things that can be addressed in the work group. This is such an exciting opportunity, and I really thank you, Representative Kotek, for it.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lowe, I saw that you were having a consultation with someone. Do you want to add anything more very quickly? Because our time is running out.
Just that there was a minor inflationary increase in the monthly stipend this last time. But other than that, we ignored them.
Yes. Indeed. Thank you, ladies, both very much for your testimony and for all
you're
that
welcome.
You're doing for the media in the state of Oregon. Was there anyone else here wish to put a chance to testify? Seeing none. Colleagues, as Representative Kotek acknowledged, we are setting up a work group, and I've asked Representative Maurer to be on that along with Representative Kotek, and I want to make sure that the Oregon Center for the Public Policy and, of course, the Department of Human Services and the Oregon Law Center. And can you think of anyone else, any other stakeholders that should be on this work group? Representative?
Sure. Could we have someone from the disability community on that work group to address some of those employment issues?
Absolutely.
I see, Madam Chair, I see Catherine White with the DD Coalition.
Eight.
Maybe Robbie. Okay.
So is there anyone else who should be on this work group? Terrific. And if something else has come up. Pardon?
My name's Tom Hember, Child Support.
Come on up forward, Tom, please.
Madam Chair, we're definitely going to be speaking with Child Support, probably at our first work group, I hope, because of the differentiation in the Child Support issue.
Great. Yeah. And if you could just give us a quick rundown of what you're wanting to tell us.
My name is Tom Hedberg. I'm the policy manager with the Child Support Program out of the Department of Justice. Our concern is the fiscal impact on the program due to the financial makeup of our budget, the Child Support Program budget. These monies currently that we would be passing through to the clients are used to maintain the program and would have to have some kind of action done to replace them or to look at some other way to fund the program in regards to those funds.
Thank you for letting us know that. That's certainly an issue that we need to take into consideration. Any quick questions of this gentleman? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So can you think of anyone else who should be on the work group? All right. I would like to briefly tell you the kinds of things I'd like you to work on. We need to talk about two-parent families, individuals with disabilities. We've already addressed that, and especially those who might be SSI eligible. The post-HANA program and the possibility of 12-month extension.
I'm sorry, ma'am.
12-month extension. Sanctions, engaging clients, and the issues that would disqualify. And the definition of a dependent child, removing deprivation. I'll give you these notes, and you've got them in one of your files. Okay? And the time limits. And, of course, the issue of child support we were just talking about. And we talked about initial assessment. I'd also like you to be talking about case management. And we didn't talk much in hearings about people doing community work, but I think that's an issue that should be looked at also as a work experience. And parents of scholars, that wasn't brought up here, but that's an issue that Representative Deborah Kefauria and I worked on in 2001, and I'd like to, of course, see that progress and improve and get larger. Any other issues that anybody want to talk about in the work group? All right. Any questions about the work group? And I would assume that this will be starting up soon.
Monday?
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yes, Madam Chair, we have two meetings scheduled for next week.
Fantastic. Good.
I promise to provide treats because we have a lot to cover.
Great. It's going to take a lot of time, I know. And again, Representative Kotek, everybody has been telling you what a great job you've done, and indeed you have.
So thank you. Well, this is a team effort, so thank you.
Yeah. Good.
Yes, we will reserve judgment until after the argument.
Thank you. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills 2180 and 2469. Anything for the good of the order? We'll be meeting Monday. And remember, daylight savings time changes. So it will feel like...